Let me ask you something. What if there was someone out there who kept a log of every single thing you did every minute of the day? That would probably creep you out. Well, that's exactly what happens every time you go online. Your internet provider stores logs of every website you've ever visited and can legally sell this data to anyone. Worse yet, the government can obtain your data via bulk FISA order even if you're not personally suspected of any crime. That's why I use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers so your internet provider can't see or log what you do online. Visit expressvpn.com/Mullen right now and find out how you can get 3 months for free. That's expressvpn.com/Mullen. Protect your data and get 3 months for free today.
Every revolution starts in the minds of the people. Arm yourself for the war of ideas. Take back your life. Take back your liberty. Tom Mullen talks freedom.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Tom Mullen Talks Freedom. Today, I'm very happy to have as my guest one of my favorite authors, who's been on the show before, Tom DiLorenzo, author of a few of the books that I would recommend anybody read to understand not just economic history, but the history of the United States. And those include Hamilton's Curse, How Capitalism Saved America. And of course, I think his what he's most known for, The Real Lincoln. And he's written some other books about Dishonest Abe as well. But today, for anybody who doesn't know, I'm very happy to announce that Tom is also now taken on the role of president of the Mises Institute. So congratulations on that, Tom, and welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm pleased to be with you.
I'd hate to think that anybody who listens to this podcast doesn't know what the Mises Institute is all about. But for anybody who doesn't, or maybe a new listener, can you give us kind of the elevator pitch on what is the Mises Institute? How long has it been around and what's its goal?
Well, it was founded 42 years ago by Lou Rockwell with the help of Murray Rothbard, Henry Hazlitt, Ron Paul, and Margaret von Mises, Ludwig von Mises' wife. And the purpose has always been to carry forward scholarship and education in Austrian school economics, you know, so named because some of the inventors of this school of thought were from Austria, sort of like the Chicago School of Economics also has nothing to do with the city of Chicago. It's just the people who are associated with that way of thinking about economics happen to be teaching at the University of Chicago. So sometimes people ask me, what's this Austrian thing? You know, how are you involved in the government of Austria? That's you know, I'm not. It has nothing to do with the country of Austria. But Mises himself was the preeminent critic of socialism in the early 20th century and even late 19th century and of fascism. He was hunted by the Nazis because he was not only a critic of fascism, but he was Jewish. And so he ended up in America and he had an office at New York University for several decades, came here in 19 after the war and after World War II, and he died in 1973. But Murray Rothbard became the first academic vice president of the Mises Institute. So a lot of what we do is Rothbardian economics and libertarian philosophy also in terms of our research. And we publish books, we hold conferences, we have a summer school, Mises University. We've had over 4,000 students over 35 years or so going through Mises University. And we have podcasts, and we have what I think is the best economics website in the world, Mises.org. You can get a great education without going to school or spending a dime on Mises.org. We've got Tom, some months we have some of our books like Man, Economy, and State by Murray Rothbard downloaded 30,000 times a month. Wow. And Human Action tens of thousands of times from all over the world. And so the business model has always been to educate the general public in the economics of freedom and the evils of interventionism and socialism. And we're not a think tank. We don't necessarily want to comment on the latest bill before Congress, although there's nothing wrong with that, but that's not our focus. We don't want to influence congressional staffers like some of the DC think tanks do. We're all about education and scholarship. We publish academic journals also.
And when did you take over as president? I got an email and I can't remember if it was in January or
October 30th was my first day.
Really? It's been that long.
I became an official employee on October 30th. So the board of directors hired me in October and I started right away. I worked from home for a while remotely. I was living in South Carolina at the time. But just 2 days ago, I closed on a house here in Auburn. So I'm now in Auburn and I'm in my office. It's being renovated at the moment, but not right this second. But so I'm here.
All right. So bear with me for a minute for some Tom Mullen history because it involves you. So I had never heard, I have a bachelor's degree in English and a master's degree from the State University College at Buffalo here. I'm in Buffalo, New York, for anyone who doesn't already know. If this makes it to video, you can see Buffalo behind me, the skyline.
Yeah, the great Ralph Rachel taught there.
Yeah. I had never heard the word libertarian until the year 2000, believe it or not. It's supposedly educated as I was. And it was actually a discussion at work, and I was in a warehouse, and there was all this kerfluffle about the election with George Bush and Al Gore and who won it and the Chads and all that for the people that remember that. And everyone was airing their political views, and I aired a few of mine, and this guy from the warehouse comes up to me, and he's like, can I ask you something? What would you describe as your political philosophy? And I described what it was. And his eyes lit up and he said, oh, you're a libertarian. I said, I am. Yeah. And he immediately reached into his desk. This is when the internet was pretty new. So it wasn't like he was going to text me a link and start pulling out these magazines, handing them to me. And I'm like, oh, thanks. And so anyway, I started looking into this and I found, the Libertarian Party website. And I went, yeah, well, that sounds right. That I can't believe there's actually a party that I would agree with, okay? Mm-hmm. Because all I knew was the Democrats and the Republicans, and I knew I didn't agree with them. So to make a long story short, I started looking for things, and I remember stumbling on this article by this guy named Lou Rockwell. Now, I didn't know anything about the Mises Institute, which at that point, as you say, had been there for 20 years or whatever. And I said, well, this guy, I really like this guy, but I just thought that's just some guy that wrote an article. And I didn't, and it wasn't until Ron Paul ran that I kind of discovered all of you people at the Mises Institute. And at the time, I found the Lou Rockwell website and I was like, oh, there's that guy. You know, I love this guy. And at the time, his website, lrc.com, I mean, the people you would read every day were Tom Woods, Karen DeCoster Campbell, Will Grigg, and Tom DiLorenzo. And I think it was right around that campaign or a few years after that you came out with Hamilton's Curse. Is that maybe late 2000s?
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah. And that I actually read that before I read The Real Lincoln. But to me, those books really made me understand conservatism the way I understand it, that the philosophy, because I really believe that the conservative economic policy is mercantilism, because they see everything as a war. And of course, if it's an economics, well, we got to win against the other countries, and that's one way of looking at it in any case. And it's like, oh, so Hamilton, he wanted the tariffs, he wanted the roads, da, 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 da. And then, oh, Lincoln, he's the same guy. He just, he latched onto the slavery thing, but he was really trying to do the same thing. And so I would encourage anybody who wants to understand the conservative and liberal ways of thinking, as opposed to libertarian or classical liberal, to read those two books, one right after the other, Hamilton's Curse and then The Real Lincoln. And to me, that just explains the 19th century as far as the other side of the argument from the free market. And I guess, you know, that's one of the things that that I wanted to ask you about. So we've got Trump running against Biden again, and I really see Donald Trump is a quintessential Hamiltonian in that he wants protective tariffs. He loves the big, wonderful military. He doesn't want to use it as much. I think he's probably less, you know, Hamilton always seemed to be itching for that war with Spain.
Yes.
That they finally got, you know, 100 years later or whatever. But Trump might be a little more reserved. Would you say that's a fair assessment, though, of his economic worldview?
Yeah, when Trump gave his first speech on economics after he was elected president, he went to Kentucky, he went to Louisville, because it's the sort of the home or the museum there of Henry Clay. And Henry Clay was the sort of the political son of Alexander Hamilton. And Hamilton, he favored protectionist tariffs, which is a form of corporate welfare. He favored corporate welfare, that is government taxpayer subsidies to select corporations, and a bank run by politicians, a national bank run by politicians. There's a good idea. And then when he died in a duel with Aaron Burr in 1804, almost at the same time that Henry Clay got into politics, and Henry Clay, by the time you get to the 1830s, was the leader of the Whig Party, and he picked up that mantle of corporate welfare, protectionist tariffs. He owned a large hemp plant, slave plantation in Kentucky, and he wanted protectionist tariffs on foreign hemp and any other substitute for hemp. And he wanted the government to pay for roads and canals so they could bring his hemp to market. He said that's why he got into politics. Wasn't any grand humanitarian plan that he had. It was to make more money on his slave plantation. And Trump went there because Trump apparently wanted to associate himself with corporate welfare. And he's president now, so he must have been thinking, well, now I can dish out millions or billions to my corporate buddies out there and then brag about how many jobs they're creating, and we'll all be happy. And that's what he did. So yeah, you're right. He was a Hamiltonian through and through, just like Henry Clay was and just like Abraham Lincoln was.
Yeah, and I know that it just stuck right out at me that in one of his speeches the first time through, whether it was during his campaign or maybe it was after he was president, he was letting everybody know they had tariffs back then, and he invoked I think it was Lincoln, and he might have invoked Henry Clay. I don't know who that guy that does most of the heavy lifting over there. Stephen Miller probably fed him that line, but Trump was very excited to let people know this is kind of an American thing. But so you have Trump, and I guess the other thing that comes to mind is that you being an economist, economics, I know to say Adam Smith invented economics is not really true, but he certainly kind of put it on the map a lot more than it was before then. And really, his whole treatise, Wealth of Nations, is about combating mercantilism, combating the Hamiltonian, the Henry Clay, or the Donald Trumpian worldview. So we're going back here now 300 years. Like, this stuff just never seems to go away.
Yeah, that's a good description of this famous book, The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776. And when I was in graduate school, I took three courses in the history of economic thought from a very great scholar, Edwin G. West, in that area. And he sort of mocked Hamilton. Hamilton, he was around at that time. Well, shortly after that time, he was really young at 1776. But he fully embraced mercantilism, which was, you know, the American colonists fought a revolution to escape being the victims of British mercantilism. And so the revolution is over, and Hamilton and his cabal of big businessmen from New York and Philadelphia, who were really his puppet masters in, once he got into politics after the revolution, they wanted to bring the rotten, corrupt British system of mercantilism to America as long as they could be in charge of it and profit from it. And so in a sense, he was a traitor to the revolution in an economic sense by doing that. When I make public speeches, I compare this to the scene in, I think it was History of the World Part 2, the Mel Brooks movie, where Mel Brooks plays the King of France. And his laugh line is, it's good to be the king, because someone comes in to him with a palette full of gold bars. And he looks into the camera and says, it's good to be the king. And I think that's what Hamilton and his benefactors, his New York and Philadelphia benefactors, thought of. It's a bad idea to be on the paying end of a mercantilist empire. But if you're in charge and you're collecting the money, it's a good thing. It's good to be the king of a mercantilist empire, just like it was good for King George. And so Hamilton, by the way, wanted a King George. He, at the Constitutional Convention, he proposed a permanent president who would appoint all the governors, who would have veto power over all state legislation. And so it basically the British Empire without the British.
Yeah. And I think, and going back to your book, he said something to the effect of that the British government was the greatest that had ever existed, and we should imitate it as closely as possible. Right. And I want to say that I can't say that he said these words, but it was almost like, well, I'd have a king if people would have it. But I know I can't get away with that here. So how about president for life?
Yeah. We didn't have a king. Yeah. I think what you're referring to is there was a dinner, I think at Monticello, because Thomas Jefferson described it in a letter that's published. And it was Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, the Secretary of State, John Adams was there. And it was John Adams who said the British Constitution is the greatest constitution ever devised. Mm. And the government is the best government, except for the corruption, John Adams said. And Hamilton intervened and said, oh, no, the corruption is a good thing, because the government is much too small if it's restrained by a constitution. It's the corruption that allows it to be bigger. And Hamilton was always wanting bigger government. He can never get big enough government. And which is why, by the way, once the Constitution was ratified in America, he condemned it. He called it a frail and worthless fabric. And he stormed out of the Constitutional Convention after throwing a hissy fit, because he didn't get his way. And he went back to New York and huddled with his big business benefactors, and then returned. But he didn't get his way. He didn't get a king. He didn't get a national bank. They rejected that. And they didn't get full-blown mercantilism. We didn't get that really until the Lincoln administration.
So it's probably fair to say, and one of the things that I always notice that that Trump says, and I want to get to Biden and the other side of this in a second, but he always refers to the largest corporations in America as our corporations, as if they belong to the country rather than the shareholders. And I mean, to describe the Hamiltonian system, is, as you say in your book, it really is to describe our system today. We have the bank he wanted. We have, a private property system, but where the biggest corporations are subsidized, they're protected from competition. The government builds all the roads now, something that they couldn't get through up until Lincoln. Isn't Donald Trump just campaigning, let's just keep what we have here, which is the Hamilton's curse?
Yeah. It's basically the same thing as fascism in terms from an economic perspective, minus the anti-Semitism of the Nazis and all that stuff. But But economic fascism was like in Germany in the 30s, they nationalized about half of the German economy, and we're about half nationalized. If you look at all the taxes Americans pay, it takes up almost half of 40% anyway of national income. And so and the rest of it, you know, we have government regulation that controls so many aspects of our life, especially business life, that we're way past half nationalized. But in Nazi Germany, the other half was private, yes, but it was so heavily regulated and regimented by the government that it might as well have been nationalized, de facto nationalized. And that's what fascism was. And so the fascist governments, Italy, Germany, in the 20th century, they were constantly bailing out these industries because they took over them essentially through regulation and control. And that's our system. It's basically the same thing, you know, very similar as mercantilism. Murray Rothbard defined mercantilism broadly as a system of policies that benefit producers at the expense of consumers. And that's pretty much Hamiltonianism. That's the Lincoln system. That's Henry Clay, and it's Donald Trump also.
So, yeah, and I think I must have read this probably on the Mises.org website, which we'll link to here. The only difference when I try to talk to people about fascism, I usually say, "Well, look at forget the Nazis because they weren't the pure fascism because of Hitler and his thing with the Jews." And you really didn't have that element with Mussolini and those fascists, but they did. I mean, they would have the private owners of the business, but if he didn't go along with what the government was telling him to produce or how much or at what price, they literally had guys go in there and physically remove him. And that's probably the only difference we have now, is that they'll use a less, you know, direct means of controlling what the businesses do. They'll just bury them in regulations and fines, but really to achieve the same result, right? And all of this is anti-competitive. I mean, only the biggest corporations can comply with all this. So you kind of get a cartelization and an exclusion of innovation.
And that's why you often see some of the biggest corporations going along with more government regulation. And then they pat themselves on the back publicly, acting like they're doing it for the public interest. But really, they understand that their smaller competitors can't afford the enforcement costs. And their would-be competitors, potential competitors will say, "Oh, if I get into this business, I'm going to have to hire a ton of lawyers to help me, you know, navigate through Washington, D.C. and the regulations. I'll do something else with my money." And so they understand that, and they have for a very long time.
So the other side of this, and let's just do the conceit for now that Joe Biden really is doing anything besides, you know, shuffling to the podium and trying to read it, you know, the notes they gave him. But the economics of the other side, a lot of people would say, well, this isn't socialism. And I remember all the Democratic candidates during the 2020 campaign, when there was 16 or 17 of them, "Are you a capitalist or a socialist?" It was refreshing to hear that asked. And I would say 14 out of 16 of them said, "Oh, I'm a capitalist. I'm for the free market," a Democratic candidate. And I guess what they would say is, "Well, I don't want, you know, the government owning the bread factory and the shoe factory and whatever, and running the stores. I just want fairness." So are they socialists or are they something besides mercantilist or capitalist? What are they?
Yeah, the Democratic Party is socialist through and through. That's what I call them. I call it the Demo Bolshevik Party now. And the modern version, today's version of socialism, is cultural Marxism. It's the international communist movement decided in the early 20th century that they failed to have communist revolutions in Europe and America because the people just didn't get enough people behind them. And so they went to work. They said, well, how can we get more people behind us? They had reinvented the old class struggle theory. It's no longer the capitalist versus the working class. They defined an oppressor class and an oppressed class. The oppressor class is basically white heterosexual males, and the oppressed is everybody else. And you see everything that the Demo-Bolshevik Party does today is based on that, the demonization of white men, the demonization of Western civilization. They started out 30 years ago denouncing dead white European males. Anything done by dead white European males, they said, was evil, like the Constitution, the rule of law, the free market economy. All these ideas have to go. And so that's who they are. And so that's why they've done away with merit. You know, a good question to ask anybody is better than, are you a capitalist? Are you in favor of hiring people according to merit? And of course, every single one of these politicians, if they were truthful, would say, no, I'm in favor of hiring according to skin color and gender, and preferably both. And that, because that's what they do. And that's the new Marxism. They call it cultural Marxism, and they sometimes call it woke. You know, supposedly they awoke to the truth about the world, you know, that socialism can work after all. And so it's very different than the old socialism, you know, the old Marxian class conflict. But that's what it is today. We see it everywhere. No, the corporations, the media, even a lot of the churches, it's all the same thing. And it's all 100% socialist. In fact, I just finished reading a book, a very interesting book, Mao's America, by a woman named Xi Van Fleet. She grew up in China during the Cultural Revolution under Mao Zedong. And so she experienced the horrors of socialism as a child. And she miraculously ended up coming, after Mao died, getting to America to go to school. And she married an American man. She became a citizen. And then she's horrified in the last 10 years at seeing some of the identical things that she witnessed as a young woman in China in the 60s and 70s happening here. And it's all cultural Marxism is what Mao's revolution was all about. And so we have an American version of cultural Marxism infecting our society today. And the Democratic Party, which I call the Demo-Bolshevik Party, is the means by which they hope to enslave us all in their socialist utopia.
All right. So I want to ask you, going back to what you said about the early 20th century, I think it was the 1930s, and I think you're talking about Marcuse and the Frankfurt School.
The Frankfurt School. Yeah.
Okay. So they, and what I remember, there's this quip from John, I believe it's John Steinbeck, that said, well, you know, we never got a workers' revolution in America because a poor American man didn't think of himself as oppressed. He thought of himself as a temporarily embarrassed millionaire or something to that effect. And, you know, ha ha ha. But the real reason is, as you said, that nothing that Marx predicted came true. And I had to read Das Kapital in school. I took some economics in school. That's another whole side story. I don't think we have time for it. But I decided that economics was a waste of time because it bore no resemblance to the real world, even as I, as an 18 and 19 year old, saw it. Because of course I was being taught Keynesian economics and the circular flow of income and all this stuff, and I thought that this is gooey. This is anyway. But here's a question that I have. You hear a lot. Well, Marx made a lot of good points about capitalism. He just had the wrong solution, something to that effect. Did he make any good points? Because one of the things that I remember from Das Kapital was that he said that the crisis that would occur would be that the workers' wages would be ground down to where they couldn't afford the products they were making, which is the opposite of what happened. Their wages went up. The prices of the products went down. This is kind of the central thing that he said was going to happen. Were there any good points from Marx or not?
That did happen, but it happened in all the socialist countries. That's where he called it the subsistence theory of wages. And that's exactly what happened in the Soviet Union and China, anywhere that adopted socialism. The workers got worse and worse and worse. But under capitalism, capital investment and entrepreneurship is what enriched the working class. Rush Limbaugh used to say, no one ever got a job from a poor man. And so it's the ability of capitalist entrepreneurs to take risks and invest to create businesses and hire people that creates prosperity and makes the working class better off. And for example, when I was at a university economics professor for 41 years, and I taught real world economics based mostly on the Austrian school, as opposed to the kind of crap you were exposed to, the Keynesian economics. But, one simple example of this is when in farming, when a farmer invested, who had farm workers as employees, invest in a tractor. So all of a sudden, you don't have to walk behind a horse all day to plow the field. You ride a tractor, and it's 100 or 1,000 times more productive in terms of farming. And so the farm becomes infinitely more valuable, and so does the farm worker. Because if the farm worker is not there to run the tractor, you're out of business. And so competition between employers forces employers to pay the workers more whenever something like this happens. And so that's what drives wages up. The primary driver of wages is capital investment by businesses and technology and capital. And yes, the accumulation of skill is important, and the education, but this increases wages only very slowly over the time, very in terms of percentages. Where you see the big jumps up in history in the well-being of the working people, it's from capital investment and inventions and new equipment and new technology, the assembly line invented by Henry Ford and things like that. That's what caused it. And that's what caused more leisure time for the working class, as well as higher wages. It's economic growth and capitalism. But Marx was right about subsistence, but it was in the socialist countries that happened and is happening today.
Another thing you just reminded me that he said that when, let's say a worker is making something by hand and then that job becomes mechanized, he said that the workers, skill now, the value of it goes to zero. And I suppose, number one, no, the ones that still make them best by hand, now they can sell those for far more. It's handmade. Look, it's handmade, and it costs a lot more. But as you say, well, that worker who used to make the wooden whatevers by hand is going to be the kind of person who's going to run the new machine, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And of course, make a lot That's more right. money. So, I mean, is there any value in anything Marx did, or was he just a hack? That's kind of the question that's bugged me for a long time about him.
Yeah, there are some things he said. He described the market process pretty accurately in some of his writings, the process, but he objected to the end result of the process. You could compare some of his writings on the evolutionary nature of competition under capitalism to Adam Smith or Ludwig von Mises, for that matter. And you'd have Adam Smith praising that process and Karl Marx condemning it because he didn't like the outcome, too much inequality and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I wouldn't say there's nothing at all that he said that was right. But on the big things, like the thing you just mentioned, the subsistence theory of wages, he was dead wrong. The labor theory of value ignores the value put together by entrepreneurs and inventors and things like that. I think only labor creates value. That's ridiculous. And so all the big things, big theories, of Marx were like that. You know, in the Communist Manifesto by Marx and Engels, it's I used to read parts of this in my classes. One of the classes I taught was called Capitalism and Its Critics. And one of the passages there, he essentially says, you know, under communism, once we get rid of the division of labor and all this stuff under capitalism, then a man could be an architect in the morning, he could be a literary critic in the afternoon, and then he can be something else in the evening. You know, you don't have to specialize in anything. And the students would all think, they would start laughing, like this guy must have been a lunatic. He's been insane. I would actually put online, I have an online version of the Communist Manifesto on my syllabus for this course. And I had students coming up to me saying, you know, this is the fourth time I was assigned to read the Communist Manifesto, but this is the first time that the professor looked at it as a historical artifact and not a roadmap for the future. And so that's what they had been taught by the philosophy professor and the history professor, that why don't we try this? Did you ever read the Communist Manifesto? Read it and then let me know what you think. I think it's a nice, good idea. We should, our society should be more like this. And that's what a lot of college students are taught. That's why they're manning the barricades of all the woke hysteria that we see. They've been taught that since kindergarten.
So getting back to the Democrats, and I think back now, I can't even believe it's 10 years or more since it's been around. But when you look at something like Obamacare, whatever the rhetoric was around it, didn't it come out to be much more of a mercantilist, gift to the corporations? There's nothing really strictly socialist about it that would be different from something Alexander Hamilton might have wanted, you know, for health insurance. Or am I wrong on that?
Yeah, it's a big subsidy to the health insurance companies and the drug companies. And so, government taking on more and more tax payments for drugs and hospital treatment and so forth. So, yeah, it's a big corporate welfare scam in the name of helping the people.
It's privately owned and competition is eliminated because, and I actually was in the health insurance industry in the 90s for like a decade, but competition, and this had started back then, where at least in New York State, the plans had to offer this baseline set of covered services where you had to all cover the same thing. We actually had a meeting in the 90s where among the managers were basically the message was, look, our only way to compete with the other insurances is to do better service and to be more efficient because we can't offer as a diverse a set of products because they all got to be the same. And that really, I think, would describe a large part of Obamacare. Now everybody's got to buy, you know, if you're a woman, you're still paying for prostate surgery. And if you're a man, you're still paying for obstetric care and all kinds of crazy things. Is the difference, do you think, that they have this egalitarianism as the end goal where the Republicans have national greatness? Or...
Well, yeah, Obama was a lifelong socialist. His father was a communist who got kicked out of his job for the Kenyan government for being sort of a radical communist plotting to overthrow the government. He said his mentor is this guy, Franklin Marshall, who's his best friend, was a KGB agent from Russia. And, you know, all these shady characters that Obama writes about in his autobiography. And he said that he only took courses from the socialist professors when he was at Occidental College. And so, yeah, he's a lifelong socialist. And so yeah, a lot of this is based on egalitarianism as far as Obamacare goes. That's why they celebrated it so much. It's just a tax on one group of Americans to subsidize and buy votes from another group of Americans. Same old story.
Yeah. And Would you say, I mean, obviously there isn't a 95% of the population is a Republican or a Democrat and buys into one of these two ways of looking at least our economic lives. The two questions that are on my mind, you can answer either one in either order. How in the world did laissez-faire ever happen to the extent it did? I sometimes go back, like, how did the United States ever happen the way it existed, at least until the turn of the 20th century? And is there really any realistic way back towards it at all?
Well, there was no Fed and there was no income tax until 1913. And so once the government had the income tax and the Federal Reserve, then they could do almost anything, you know, even with war. If there was a massive desertion crisis, as there was during the Civil War, for example, there are books on desertion in the Civil War where that I've read, where on the eve of a big battle, there might have been 80,000 Union Army troops in camp. And then the sun comes up on battle day and there's 20,000 that just disappeared. And the government did not have the resources to run to find them. But once you got the income tax and the Fed, the government has unlimited resources to run down deserters and do just about anything else. So it's no accident that we had this industrial revolution at a time where there's no income tax and no Fed. Although we had creeping mercantilism, you know, for decades and decades all during that era, but it was minuscule compared to what we ended up with, you know, by the New Deal era, the 1930s, as far as interventionism goes.
And I guess I got to ask you about this guy, because he describes himself as an Austrian economist as well as a anarcho-capitalist. What do you make of Javier Milei in Argentina? And what do you think his chances of making, you know, real fundamental changes are there?
Well, he's kind of schizophrenic. He gives great speeches from a libertarian perspective. Yeah, and I've read that he has actually a budget surplus all of a sudden in just a couple of months in Argentina. And it just destroyed entire bureaucracies, you know, just got rid of them in his government. So he's doing great with that sort of thing. And I loved it when he went in front of these weirdo fascists at the World Economic Forum and spoke the truth to them, told them who they were, how socialism is a disaster, it always has been. And you all need to become libertarian economists like me, basically, is what he was saying. But then on the other hand, the first thing he did also was to go to Israel and pledge his everlasting support for any war that Israel and America get involved in. I read this morning he's going to Ukraine in June to hug and kiss Zelensky and to urge to commit his countrymen, Argentinians, to supporting in some way this rat hole of the Ukrainian war. And so he's like a neocon warmonger on foreign policy, and he's a Ron Paul on domestic policy. I guess half a loaf is better than no loaf, is what you can say about him. And so I've had people associated with the Mises Institute, including a board member or two. Well, you know, they read Zelensky's speech at the World Economic Forum. They said, well, every year we have a supporters summit for donors somewhere. It's a really always a nice big event. It's done Hilton Head Island in October this year. And they would say, well, why we should invite Milei to be the speaker. And I've said, can't do that because of his foreign policy views. His economic views are great, but his foreign policy. And, you know, and war is the health of the state. And so, and you know, if you adopt that viewpoint, you're really contradicting yourself. You're a walking contradiction, because you can't be a libertarian and say I'm in favor of minimal government or anarcho-capitalist and no government, and be in favor of the warfare state at the same time. That's just an inherent contradiction. And so that's how I would describe him.
Yeah, that's too bad. And I had no idea about that. I've only seen limited things I've seen on Twitter. I did catch where he's got a whiteboard with all the departments, and he's like ripping the names of the departments off the board and yelling afuera, which I guess means outside or go outside.
Yeah, that's great that he has the power. I guess their constitution is different than ours. They can do that.
Yeah. Would you say that if we have the choice between the two systems, that let's face it, we had a lot of mercantilism after Lincoln, when the Republicans dominated from the post-Civil War through the early 20th century. Is that less damaging than the socialism the Democrats are offering?
Yeah, it is, because what the demo Bolshevik Party wants is totalitarianism. That's what, you know, the canceling people who disagree with them, the attack on the First Amendment, the attack on the Second Amendment, the proposals to arm illegal aliens and let them join the army, and that thing. They want totalitarian control. The Republican Party, they just want to help their friends get rich so that their friends could keep them in their crappy jobs in Congress. So that's basically what they're all about. And that's much less dangerous to the average American than these utopian totalitarian dreamers who run the demo Bolshevik Party.
And the bottom line is, you know, we get these because most of the population supports one or the other. And I know people say, well, I only had these two choices, but no, I mean, you nominated these people. That's why we have these choices.
Well, the other choice we have is secession.
Right. But I guess one of the things I wonder about is there's just no emotional. There's no emotional value to the free market. Never tells you what you want to hear. Like, what I want to hear is, if I'm not rich, it's because, you know, there's somebody else did something. Somebody's oppressing me. That's a great message. You know, oh, it's not my fault. You know, or if I'm not richer, even if I am rich and I want to be even richer, you know, that's kind of, you know, well, that's because, these foreigners are, selling or dumping cheap products on our markets or whatever. And I guess I just don't, and I guess the same question I get back to, how was the population ever so committed that these ideas, even the mercantilist ones, lost election after election? How did that American population get there, if you know?
Yeah, well, you know, the government schooling is dominating.
No. I don't mean how did they get to where they are now. How did they get to the point where there was, you know, broad support for classical liberal ideas, at least for a while?
Well, you started off with the colonists and the American Revolution and the ideas of John Locke, and you had Thomas Jefferson, who was his influence was enormously powerful up until the Civil War. Basically, the U.S. government basically was Jeffersonian, predominantly Jeffersonian, until the Civil War. You know, all the things that Hamilton wanted, protectionist tariffs, we had basically free trade on the eve of the Civil War. There were no federal subsidies to speak of to anybody on the eve of the Civil War. There was no central bank. There was no income tax. And then the war changed all of that, including the income tax, which was ended in the 1870s and then brought back decades later. But that's how this was possible. It was not just that the government, we didn't have a Fed and we didn't have an income tax. The ideas articulated by people like the Jeffersonians and the Jacksonians, too, by the way. The politicians who were... maybe not Jackson and Andrew Jackson himself at all times, but the Jacksonians were pretty much libertarians, and they were very influential. And one of the things, if you read about the Civil War era, like I have as a hobby, one of the things you read is that the American public in those days was very well read, much better than today, I would say. And so, and they wrote letters a lot. And so, they were hungry to get newspapers and read about current events and things like that. And so these ideas weren't filtering down from the Jeffersonians and the scholars and the writers to Joe and Jane Sixpack, as I call them, who could understand some of these things pretty easily. And of course, that was before the government stepped in and dumbed down the schooling, too.
Yeah.
You know, people who did go to school, you know, in 1850, a sixth grade education was probably more than the equivalent of a college degree today at your average state university.
Yeah, it is incredible. I've had Patrick Newman on, and his book Cronyism really learned quite a bit about the Jacksonians. And he actually argues, look, they were more Jeffersonian in a lot of ways than Jefferson and the early Jeffersonians. And that's published by the Mises Institute, correct?
Yes, it is. It was a Mises Institute book. Yeah, it takes a culture. There has to be a culture of economic freedom. And that's what the Mises Institute is all about, trying to promote this and save the culture of economic freedom in terms of the culture of ideas that support the idea of economic freedom and that warn people about the dangers of socialism and interventionism. It's not just these institutions like the Fed or the absence of the Fed, that there has to be a culture of ideas in support of these things. And that's what the Jeffersonians and the Jacksonians did a good job of.
Well, I could keep you here for another hour, but I know you don't have that kind of time. One thing I'll say to everybody, if you like Milton Friedman, for example, and the Chicago School, like, boy, he really sold the free market. You'll like the Mises Institute even better, because those little things that bother you about the Chicago School, and Friedman was great, but even some of the things were, you know, well, he seems to need the state for this or that. You'll find the pure stuff, you know, polluted by anything at Mises.org. What are the next big events coming up that the Institute's putting on?
Well, in May, we have a Human Action Conference. The famous book by Ludwig von Mises, Human Action, 75th anniversary this year. And so we're putting on a big conference in mid-May. You can go on to Mises.org and click on events and find all the information about it. We have some of the top Austrian economics scholars in the world coming to Auburn for this event. And people who make a donation, different types of donations, everyone will get, there's going to be a book published based on all the papers presented. And we're coming out with a new leather-bound edition of the book Human Action also. That's one thing that we're doing. We have our annual Mises University in the summer. We usually have 100 to 150 college students from all over the world to come to study free market economics for a week. And then they go back and we help them out with throughout their school years, even long after they've left Auburn, Alabama in the summer. And it has a big impact on a lot of people, has had a big impact on a lot of people's lives. And in the future, we're planning on some conferences on war, the political economy of war. And you could call it revisionist history, but the history of war through the lens of Rothbardian libertarianism and free market economics, which is what we're all about. And so we're going to do that in the future also, among other things.
All right. Sounds good. We'll definitely link to that big event on Human Action and some of your books. I recommend them highly. Tom, thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Tom. Always a pleasure. Thanks.
All right, friends, that's going to do it for today. Just a few reminders to stop by TomMullenTalksFreedom.com/support and check out all the ways that you can support my efforts here, including joining my Patreon or my Substack. And if you haven't already, make sure that you go to itsthefedstupid.com to download a copy of my free ebook, It's the Fed Stupid. And as always, if you like the music you've heard here on Tom Mullen Talks Freedom, you can hear more at TomMullenSings.com. Thanks for listening.
The War of Ideas has only just begun. Arm yourself with the knowledge you need by heading to TomMullenTalksFreedom.com and subscribing to our email list. And remember, every revolution starts in the minds of the people.